twist of the scandal engulfing the British Prime Minister as police saying they're investigating lockdown parties at Boris Johnson's residence. Yemen says the death toll from the Saudi Friday air raid on a prison in Sada has risen to 91. It's calling for an international probe into the attack. And also oil prices bouncing back after a sharp loss amid concerns over possible supply disruptions due to tensions in Eastern Europe and West Asia. This is World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The top story this hour, there has been another twist in a scandal engulfing Prime Minister Boris Johnson. In a U-turn, London's Metropolitan Police say that they're investigating several parties that took place at Johnson's office and other government departments during COVID lockdowns.
And what I can tell you this morning is that as a result, firstly, of the information provided by the Cabinet Office inquiry team, and secondly, my officer's own assessment, I can confirm that the Met is now investigating a number of events that took place at Downing Street and Whitehall in the last 2 years in relation to potential breaches of COVID-19 regulations.
The Met Chief acknowledged deep public concern about allegations of lockdown parties and breach of the government's own COVID guidelines. The police had previously faced sharp criticism for rejecting calls to look into the claims. The announcement comes shortly after a latest disclosure that an event was held during lockdown to celebrate Johnson's birthday on June 19, 2020. A string of such revelations has prompted the worst crisis of Johnson's premiership and calls from across the political spectrum for him to quit.
This is yet more evidence that we've got a Prime Minister who believes that the rules that he made don't apply to him. And so we've got a Prime Minister and a government that spend their whole time mopping up sleaze and deceit. Meanwhile, millions of people are struggling to pay their bills. And we can't afford to go on with this chaotic, rudderless government. The Prime Minister is a national distraction. He's got to go.
While Johnson says he welcomes the police decision to investigate the disclosures and will help give public clarity, a former aide has accused him of lying to Parliament about a garden party thrown by his office at the height of the lockdown. A report into the gatherings is set to be released this week. The so-called Partygate revelations, coupled with several other scandals, have seen a plunge in Johnson's approval ratings. Now, those include his handling of the sleazy scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Time now for the News Review program. Now, Yemen's health minister has denounced the Saudi air raid on a prison facility in Sada province, saying that the death toll has risen.
"We denounce this act against those prisoners who were killed unjustly by aggressors. 91 people were killed and more than 230 wounded, some of them seriously. The aggressors have crossed all red lines."
Yemeni officials have called for an international investigation into the airstrike that took place on Friday. It drew widespread condemnation, including from the United Nations, which also is calling for a transparent probe. The Saudi-led coalition has stepped up its air raids on Yemen in recent weeks. According to officials, since the beginning of January, the coalition's attacks have claimed the lives of at least 150 people. Yemen is under a tight blockade that has put millions of people just steps away from severe famine. Some 380,000 people have died either directly from war or indirectly from disease and hunger over the past 7 years. Now, allow me to invite a couple of experts to get some views and insight on this. So, Hamza Shaiban, Yemeni activist and political commentator, is joining us from Toronto, Ontario. Also, Edward Carrigan, international human rights lawyer, is with us from London, Ontario. Both guests from Ontario. Good to have you with us, gentlemen. Let me start with Hamza. Is Saudis, since day one that this news was out on that attack on the prison, Saudis came out and said, "We haven't done that." So if Saudis haven't done that, who has?
So, you know, for the past 7 years, the Saudi-US coalition, have launched an unlawful war against Yemenis and they could not achieve any of the political or military goals. And for them, you know, to continue this war, what they've been doing is that they've been trying to increase the suffering of the Yemeni people. And that's either through targeting, you know, civilians or by the blockade. But it's very shameful from them to say that they did not do that, because it has been proven after they targeted the detention center in Saada province that the bombs that they used is manufactured in the U.S. And this manufacturer is selling these bombs, the targeted bombs to Saudi Arabia. So it's very hard to deny that. This is not the first, you know, war crime against civilians that they've committed in Yemen. And, you know, there is no one else who can do this except them.
All right. Now, Edward, you're an international lawyer, and you know better than I do that this, I believe, does need a probe, and a transparent one, as the UN and others are calling. Would the Saudis allow this, and why shouldn't they allow this if they don't, if they say that they are not behind this?
Well, first of all, I think that there's no question that the Saudis were behind it. Doctors Without Borders and other people on the ground said that it was a Saudi attack. If the Saudis say they weren't behind it, then they would have no opposition to an investigation. But I think it's up to the government of Yemen, the United Nations, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and Human Rights should investigate this. And there is no question that the Saudis did it, and this would constitute a war crime. But also, it makes no sense. If these were opponents of the government in Sana'a, then why would they bomb it? You know, the Saudis have bombed sometimes very precision, other times very random and indiscriminate, where they've killed, you know, that many thousands of civilians, and they've destroyed infrastructure and other things. But, you know, it's, you know, this is clearly a, you know, as I said, it makes no sense. These are people that are supposedly opponents of the government in Sana'a and probably supporters of Hadi, or maybe just general common criminals. But, you know, the Saudis, you know, this is clearly constitutes a war crime in my mind, but also it's, you know, shows a profound degree of stupidity that the Saudis would bomb a prison unless the intent was to assist the prisoners to escape. But I don't think there's, you know, almost 100 prisoners were killed, including and also some children and women and children, 260 wounded. And now this is just yet another of a long list of war crimes that the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates have committed against the people of Yemen. So you have what the UN has called the world's largest man-made humanitarian disaster, you know, starvation, denying them food, medicine, fuel, and putting, you've got millions of people from Yemen on the verge of starvation. So this is quite terrible. So I would hope that the United Nations International Committee would investigate this one incident, but there are many, many other incidents too. They also attacked a communication center, which shut down the internet for all of Yemen, and when an attack on Hudaydah, the port. And, you know, this is to prevent information from getting out to the world, which again puts the Saudis in a very bad light.
Yeah, of course, schools and hospitals also being targeted on a daily basis. Now, Hamza, I want to ask you, given the situation that also Edward rightly described, you have people in Yemen dying of very easy to be cured diseases, like, you know better. And also, they don't have enough food, they don't have potable water, and the infrastructure is in ruins and all that. And then you have the international community just standing by and idly by and watching. And then you have international organizations only condemning, don't do this, don't do that. They take no action. So what option is left for the Yemenis?
I think Yemenis know very well that you know, they shouldn't be counting or relying on the international community, because for the past 7 years, all types of war crimes have been committed against them. The blockade is really making the suffering of Yemeni people immense. You have the healthcare system, 50% of it is not working because of some kind of bombardment that happened in the past. The other 50% is running, they're going out of service because they don't have access to fuel. And that's because the Saudi coalition is withholding right now 10 ships by the in the Hudaydah port, and they're not allowing you know, oil and gas into Yemen, although they have you know, permit from the UN saying that these are oil ships and they don't have any type of weapons or arms. Now, you know, just condemning what's happening in Yemen is not enough. This is what has been happening for the past 7 years. There needs to be some serious actions in ground, some serious deeds that these countries and the UN would take to stop the war. Otherwise, I think this will continue forever, and the Yemeni people don't have any other option but to defend themselves and start really hurting the countries that are involved in this war to make them feel how Yemeni people are feeling.
Right. So, Edward, apart from wars, it's action that's needed, as all of us agree. So, who should run this, let's say, transparent and independent probe? Because the UN just took the Saudis off the child-killing list, you know. So who's in charge? And there are a host of, you know, other similar instances, as you know. This is not the only crime committed.
Well, unfortunately, the United Nations is probably blocked by the veto power of the United States and Britain and even France. Plus, they've been very not pressing Saudi Arabia, who has blackmailed the United Nations for, you know, any time they've tried to condemn them for various activities. But I think the people of Yemen are right. They have to rely upon themselves. And they have shown tremendous resilience. And, you know, they're defending their country. They are actually, you know, it's a stalemate, or they're winning the war against the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates. The Saudis and the United Arab Emirates are using mercenaries and troops that don't really, are not committed to the fight. And you have, you know, the people of Yemen have shown, you know, great tenacity and ability to rely upon themselves. They've created, you know, ballistic missiles, drones, other things that they have, you know, been fighting the Saudis and this UAE and their mercenaries and defeating them on a regular basis. You know, so it's the Saudis, you know, at the very worst, it's a stalemate, but I think the Saudis and UAE are losing the war, but they're terrified of the idea that the people of Yemen could actually form their own government. You could have a popular movement with the Houthis and their allies, and this terrifies the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, which of course are autocratic feudal dictatorships. So the example of the people of Yemen taking control of their own destiny and standing up for themselves and defending their rights, I think is what really is the fear that the Saudis and the UAE and their allies have. There's no, you know, all it is dictatorships, you know, soldiers from Egypt and mercenaries from Sudan, but, you know, it's not working for the Saudis. They can bomb because the United States and Britain provides them with weapons and even targeting information. But the Saudis and the UAE do not have the ability to win this war. And hopefully, saner minds, all the Americans got to do and the British is put an arms embargo on the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, and it would force the Saudis and UAE to come to terms and have some sort of a peaceful settlement. Oman has tried to do that. The United Arab Emirates have actually said they're going to withdraw from Yemen on two occasions. They still haven't done that. So the people of Yemen have taken their destiny in their own hands, and they're, you know, are fighting and putting up a tremendous fight to maintain their own independence and not becoming, you know, dominated by the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates.
Exactly. Iran has also offered Yemen in negotiations and trying to do whatever it can to facilitate that. Okay, thank you so much for your insight. And to contribution, we had Hamza Shaiban, Yemeni activist and political commentator in Toronto, and Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer in London, Ontario. Welcome back. Moving on, oil prices bouncing back after a sharp drop amid concerns over possible supply disruptions due to mounting tensions in Eastern Europe and West Asia. Brent crude rose up to 48 cents to nearly $87 a barrel early Tuesday, after falling almost 2% the day before. Meantime, the oil producing group OPEC and its allies, together known as OPEC Plus, is struggling to hit its targeted monthly output increase. The group is sticking to its previous decision to raise output by 400,000 barrels per day, and this has further added to supply concerns. Oil markets have largely hit since the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. prices reached 7-year highs last week, bolstered by tight supply and resurging global demand. Analysts say that crude prices are heading for monthly gains of more than 10%. Now, in Iraq, the top court has confirmed the re-election of Mohammed al-Halbousi as parliament speaker, paving the way for the formation of a new government. The ruling also allows parliament to resume sessions when a new president will be selected, who in turn will choose the next prime minister. The Supreme Court rejected appeals from two parliament members who had demanded the annulment of Halbousi's re-election. They objected to the way that a parliament session was held when the speaker was elected. The appeals came after a chaotic first meeting of parliament. Rival political blocs remained divided over the October elections, with some parties questioning the electoral process. MPs have until February the 8th to elect a president. Iran's top security official rules out the possibility of direct contacts with the U.S. during the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 accord, the JCPOA. Ali Shamkhani says that Tehran and Washington have been in contact in Vienna through what it calls non-papers. He believes that such an informal way of communication is enough, and there is no need to go beyond that. Shamkhani, however, said that Iran will consider other options only if a good agreement is within reach to bring the JCPOA back into life. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been in talks in the Austrian capital since April last year. The aim is to get the U.S. sanctions on Iran removed before Washington rejoins the deal. Now, several European countries are reporting record COVID infections as the continent is struggling with a more contagious Omicron variant. Russia posted a record high of nearly 68,000 cases in the past day. That's the fifth consecutive day the country is witnessing the highest daily caseload. Some 680 new COVID-related deaths were also confirmed the same period. The Czech Republic infections hit a new high, with officials logging some 30,000 new cases in the day. The Netherlands also had more than 54,000 new daily infections. Daily COVID cases have remained high there. However, despite the surge, the government is planning to end restrictions, and that follows protests over the curbs in recent weeks. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, particularly the leftist parties, which were affiliated to the Eastern Bloc. Today we are going to continue his advice to the political parties, both affiliated to the West and the East. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini's political belief was strongly based on negation of both the East and the West. His belief was originated in the Quranic principle of La ilaha illallah, which means there is no God but Allah. In view of this, since the very start of his movement against domestic tyranny and foreign hegemony, he focused his struggle against the US and the former Soviet Union. Imam Khomeini said, "We want all Islamic countries to have this feature and the concept that has materialized in Iran to exist in all Islamic countries. That is, all the downtrodden in the world stand against the oppressors, resolve their problems, take their right, and know that the right should be taken." The Imam writes in his testament, "This absurdity and artificial, empty-headedness has caused us not to rely on our thought and knowledge in any issue and imitate the East and the West blindly. Rather, if we have any culture, literature, industry, and innovation, the West-toxicated and East-toxicated writers and speakers will castigate and ridicule them and repress and disappoint our native thought and power. And they would promote the foreign traditions and customs, no matter how cheap and disgraced they are, and would sell them to nations through extolling and praising. I recommend affectionately and humbly to the dear nation that as they have been remarkably saved from many of these traps, and the deprived generation is innovatively active to be alert, awake, and watchful so that the policy players affiliated to the West and the East may not drag you to these international looters with devilish temptations. So, stand uprising with your decisive will, activity, and perseverance to remove these dependencies." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, censuring intellectual and political dependency on the East and the West, advises the deceived groups to join the nation. He writes, "My recommendation to the Muslim groups, which are mistakenly inclined to the West and possibly to the East, and would sometimes support the hypocrites whose betrayal has been disclosed, is to not insist on their mistake. To confess their mistake with Islamic courage and, for God's pleasure, become consonant and companion with the government, the parliament, and the oppressed nation, and save these downtrodden of history from the evil of the arrogant. And keep in mind the words of late Ayatollah Mudarris, the devoted and pure clergy, who said at the dormant parliament of those days, "Now that we are to be destroyed, why should we be destroyed by ourselves? I too say to you, faithful brothers, in remembrance of that martyr of God's way, that if we are destroyed by the criminal America and the Soviet, and meet our God with noble red blood, it would be better than enjoying a luxurious life under the flag of the Eastern Red Army and the Western Black Army." Imam Khomeini advises political groups and parties to be admonished by the events of Afghanistan and the stiff resistance of the Afghan nation against the Eastern Bloc. He writes, "One must be admonished by Afghanistan, where the usurper government and the leftist parties have been with the Soviet, yet they have failed to suppress the masses of people. In addition, now the deprived nations have woken up, and it will not take long that this awakening will lead to movement, uprising, and revolution, and they will save themselves from the dominance of arrogant oppressors. And you Muslims committed to the Islamic values can see that separation and detachment from the East and the West is gradually showing its bounties, and the thoughtful native brains have become active and advancing towards self-sufficiency. And what the treacherous Western and Eastern experts used to depict as impossible to our nation has been materialized by the hand and thought of the nation. And God willing, it will materialize in the long run too."
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak for refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria and Afghanistan, all countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French president objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the Channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the Channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the Channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it, and it capsized, and they drowned this last week. And they just drowned, and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yeah,
it's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure like, an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
Sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, and I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy, but it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific, and why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilized way of helping these people?
It's very sad.
It's sad that they have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that. They'd rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible first because that's their border. And then the British government should take in care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border. I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
It's terrible. It shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
First, I suppose, used the word tragic, and it is a tragedy.
Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And, yeah, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts is entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria or Iraq. Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better-off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us so-called global Britain meddling around in the Middle East, so we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part, because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess? So
there's some implicit responsibility, because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think, obviously, they've travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first port of call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago also I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 21st century.
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because if they... I don't know, that's a tough one. Because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But I don't know, that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU over this, to be fair. It's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small, unsafe boats into the Channel. We've seen the result of that this year, so I wish that that wasn't happening.
If we start the war, obviously we should be taken responsibility for it. So, I mean, yeah.
The entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
A very complex issue, I think. It's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, are they? If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, causing tragedies, and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it, and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences, so you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the Channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause. Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them, as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible, and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments. I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in those wars. That would seem fair to me.
Allow them to make the crossing. Letting people make something that's unsafe, where they could possibly lose their lives, is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths, in a way, by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK, and possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who've been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved in?
I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees. And if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happen. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans, as common man, to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all, as a collective, need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the Channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the Channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary. You know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, we should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries in a diplomatic manner to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better like accommodation to come over on, rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got like all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything, do you know what I mean? We have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good, so we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what their, like, what country they came from, but their life matters, so they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants. So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders. First place, if they have come over risking their lives, then find the ways to settle them.
Create a safe passage. That's all we need, is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson attacked French authorities and, by implication, the French President himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings. Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.